SNI, Surgical Neurology International, and SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, are pleased to present the second monthly Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds on the topic of global solutions to clinical challenges in neurosurgery. This Grand Rounds was held on Sunday, July 7th, 2024. This talk will be presented by Professor Katanga Diu Mercy Kabulo, head of the Jason Sendway General Hospital, and also at the Coptic Provincial Hospital. He's also on the staff at the University of Zimbabwe and the University of Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The talk is on cysticercosis, a review.
Yes, let's get started. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for joining. This is the second SNI, Digital Global International Conference for Sub-Saharan Africa. We have a forum where we can learn about what's happening in neurosurgery around Sub-Saharan Africa. The first conference was a success, and we're building on that. I think we've had some glitches along the way that I think we've refined, and so we will continue to build. We have a couple of presenters. Dr. Kaba will be talking about intraoperative ultrasound in neurosurgery, and followed by Dr. Kabulo talking about neurocysticercosis surgical treatment. And then the third will be a guest speaker, Dr. Samra Host, talking about teleproctoring in the vascular neurosurgery. For the sake of time, I'll turn it over to Jim Osman, who's the head honcho for SNI and SNI Digital. And then after Jim talks, we'll turn it over to Professor Kaba.
Well, I think I don't have much to say except welcome. Nice to see everybody. And Estrada, thank you for all the work you put in on this. And let's hear from Professor Kaba about intraoperative ultrasound.
Good morning, everybody, to where you are. We are seniors, professors, and colleagues. I'm Kabulo. I'm going to talk about neurocysticercosis. I'm a consultant neurosurgeon. Trained in Zimbabwe, right now practicing in Lubumbashi, Democratic Republic of Congo. This topic, I'm going to make it very, very easy because I know that even residents are following us. So I'm going to start with the basic things, and I'll share one case we managed locally, and I'll tell you about our experience. So these are worms in the brain. So parasites are organisms that exist by exploiting a host by obtaining nutrients from it. We have different types of parasites. We have protozoa, ermine, and ectoparasites. So, and a number of these parasites can invade the central nervous system despite the protection provided by the blood-brain barrier. And cysticercosis is the most common parasitic infection involving the central nervous system. And in some low-income countries, it's the most common cause of acquired epilepsy in adult. It is caused by cysticercus cellulosa. This is a larva stage of the tapeworm Taenia solium, which has marked predilection for neurotic tissue. As you can see there, this is the larva stage, and you can see it has cold collects. It has different parts. It has four suckers, and it has also two rows of hooklets on the mouth.
Dr. Kaba, let me just interrupt for a second. If I could have everybody mute their microphones, because we're getting quite a bit of background noise.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll mute all and then you can just remute yourself. Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Like I was saying, it is embedded in some countries, like in Africa, in South America, Southern Asian countries. You see on the table, on the picture showed there, the area in red, it is showing where the disease is endemic. And the incidence of neurosis psychosis may reach 4% in some areas. And the incubation period is very, very long. Sometimes it can go up to more than a decade for you to see symptoms from the moment you are infected. So the rate of neurosis psychosis are variable, ranging from 1.2 people for every 100,000 in countries like India. To neurosis psychosis are variable due to differences in diagnosis capabilities and other causes related to the resources available country, especially in low and middle income countries. The diagnosis poses a very big problem. Let me go into a background, an historical background. From the time of ancient cultures, intestinal parasites were identified as worm. And the larval stage of the porcine tapeworm, called Thalia solium, it has been recognized in pigs for more than 2 millennia. Our ancestors, Hippocrates, Aristotle, and Theophrastus, they denominated them as flat worms initially. I think probably from Aristotle's Historia Animalum, due to their resemblance to a tape or to a band. That's why they were calling them flat band. Then Celsus and Pliny and colleagues, they called them Lumbricus latus, which means white worm. And the Thalia solium species of tapeworm was described initially by Villanovani with a term that reflected the equivocal idea that one individual could only carry one of these parasites. And later on in 1683, Tyson described the head of Thalia solium, like I mentioned before, after he saw the picture of the scolex of the parasite. Then he described those suckers, as you can see. I mentioned that you can see four suckers and two rows of hooklets. Then in 1855, Kutchenmeister identified the relationship between the ingestion of the cysty sucker and the development of teniasis. Then other people described the cyst in the corpus callosum, as well as Mr. Watton, who identified multiple cysts in adipose tissue and muscle, thinking they were glands. Though they were not glands, they were cysts of cysty suckers. And the evidence of this endemic life and its interaction with specific communities was clearly established in Dixon's study, where he found infestation of British soldiers 5 years after they stayed in India. And the currently the international consensus defines teniasis as the infestation in the intestines, and cysty psychosis like the infestation in other organs like the brain, like the muscle. The life cycle of Thalia solium and the natural issue is more complex, because usually people confuse how we get infested. It goes into three stages: the larva, the embryo, and the adult worm. So what is happening? Humans get infected by two ways. The first way is when we eat undercooked pork meat. So where they are the worm, which is encysted in the meat. So when you eat it, it will go into the intestines and grow as an adult worm. Then you get teniasis. But the second way of doing it is by eating by drinking water which is infested, by eating food which is not washed, well washed. So when you eat the eggs, which are, because the worm is, it has several parts. Those parts called proglottis, they get eggs. When you eat the eggs will go into the stomach. Then from the stomach, the shell get melt. Then the larvae are liberated. Then they can go into the circulation. Then from there, they can join the brain. They can join the muscles. They can join different organs like the heart, the eye, and so on. So these are organs which can be infested by the larvae. Like muscle, you see this, which were described last time, like all glands, but it was the cyst of the larva. Then into the heart, into the muscle, into the eye, and also into the brain, you can find those larvae. So it goes into stages. These stages, they are like evolution of the disease. So when you get even into on the CT scan, you get different stages. The vesicular stage, this picture on the left shows the vesicular stage, which correspond to the cyst that have achieved immune tolerance. This is a very well-defined cyst, which contains a dot. The white dot inside is the head of the larva called the scolex. And at this stage, you have mild. You might or not have edema, perilesional edema. Then the second stage is the colloidal stage, which corresponds to the beginning of initial host response. When you get the host response, then you start to get the perilesional edema. The third stage is the granular nodular stage, which represents further damage to the cyst, where the fluid content within the cyst are no longer discernible on imaging. So this stage, you see inside, you won't see the scolex, and the fluid inside start to finish. And the last stage is the calcific stage, where you are only seeing calcifications in the brain on imaging. And it's better to see it on CT scan, because calcification sometimes on MRI scan, you won't see it properly. So the type of neurologic involvement, you can get spinal cord involvement. You can also get giant cyst within the brain, which can go up to more than 50 millimeters. And those cysts which are being developed in the brain, they are of two types. The first one is called cysticercus cellulosae. You see they are regular, ranging from 2 to 3 to 20 millimeters, and they are round or oval. They tend to form in the parenchyma and in the narrow subarachnoid space. They contain the scolex instead of the other cyst, which is called cysticercus racemosus, which are very large, and they grow actively in the subarachnoid, and they produce inflammation. So in this type of cyst, you won't see the larva inside the cyst. Where can we find them? We have different locations. Meningeal, where you can get in the dorsolateral subarachnoid space. Usually it's the cysticercus cellulosae. You can get them in the basal subarachnoid space. You can get them into the parenchyma in 30 to 63%. They can go also into the ventricle, especially when they're in the ventricle, they block the CSF flow, and you might get hydrocephalus, or you can get the mixed lesions, and also the spinal lesions, which are very, very rare, and sometimes they don't respond well on treatment. So the clinical presentations depend on the number of lesions, depend on number of the location of the cyst. And like I said, the incubation period can go up to 30 years for you to develop symptoms. The main presenting symptoms is seizures. You get patient adult onset seizure with signs of elevated intracranial pressure. Sometimes you get neurological deficit when the cyst is big and causing mass effect. and sometimes altered mental status. So you might get also cranial nerve pulses when the cysts are in the basal, in the arachnoid space, causing basal arachnoiditis. And sometimes in the subcutaneous tissue, you might get other cysts. So the diversity of this manifestation depends mainly on the size, like I said, the number, the location of parasite. And focal signs are frequently due to local irritation or mass effect. In terms of clinical topographical presentation, when they are in the parenchyma, you will get seizures. When they are in the meninges, you might get chemical meningitis. Into the ventricle, you can get hydrocephalus, and so on. So what is happening when you are sending now the sample to the laboratory? Sometimes you get, in the blood smear, you get peripheral eosinophilia. Sometimes CSF are normal. You collect and you send to the lab, they say it's normal. Proteins might be elevated or sometimes normal. And the glucose levels, sometimes they are normal. But the what you have to request is to look for over into the stool and where you might get them in 33%. So the usual finding is the mononuclear pleocytosis with sometimes an average of 300 cells per cubic millimeters. Serology, unfortunately, sometimes in our center, like when you go in a rural area, you won't get this. You do enzyme-linked immunoelectrotransfer blood, and AIBT, which is effectively supersede ELISA, and where titer is considered significantly at 1.64 in serum and 1.8 in CSF. So false negative result can also be found. What else we do? Radiographic, you do X-ray of muscles. You can do X-ray of thighs. Then you will see calcification into the muscles. You can do skull X-ray, which is going to show you calcifications into the brain from the X-ray. And on CT scan, like I mentioned, there are different stages, vesicular stage, nodular stage, nodular glandular stage, and the calcific stage. On MRI, like I mentioned, you see the cyst with perilesional edema, which is hyperintense on T2. Calcifications sometimes are very difficult to see on MRI because calcifications are hypointense on T1 and hypointense on T2. On spectroscopy, you might see a peak of lactate, acetate, alanine, and succinate. But the presence of strong succinate with a smaller acetate peak may help to differentiate neurocysticercosis from pyogenic brain abscess. And also, if you check, you are doing your spectroscopy, you go into the cyst, you might not find choline and N-acetyl aspartate, but it can help you to differentiate a necrotic area of a brain abscess from neurocysticercosis when you are doing a spectroscopy. Because when you get a tumor with a necrotic area, you get a peak of lactate and lipid, which are not seen in neurocysticercosis. According to diagnostic criteria, in some developing countries, people are confusing this with the tuberculosis, because sometimes imaging can be the same. But now, the best way to understand the clinical spectrum of neurocysticercosis has been through diagnostic criteria, which are based on four elements: epidemiological data, immunological, radiologic, and clinical. There are these two associations, American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene and Infectious Disease Society of America, which give us these criteria to diagnose neurocysticercosis. They are absolute criteria, major criteria, minor criteria, and epidemiologic criteria. What you have to do, if it's definitive neurocysticercosis, you get one absolute criteria, or two major criteria, or one major and two minor plus one epidemiologic. If you get the combination of those, you can think about neurocysticercosis. Then we might differentiate it from tuberculosis, from brain abscess, cystic tumors with inside the brain, and sometimes to eidetic cysts. What are the treatments, what we are doing, what we are using locally here in our country? We give anti-emetic medication, anti-epileptic drugs, steroid, and surgery. And this surgery, you might do surgical resection of the cyst or the lesion, or you can do CSF diversion. Steroids are very, very important because when you are about to start medical treatment, you have to give steroid first to reduce the amount of edema. Otherwise, the patient will deteriorate while you are giving anti-emetic drug. And in our setting, what we are doing with the steroid, we start with dexamethasone, 8 milligrams, 8 hourly. Then on day 3, we decrease the dose to 4 milligrams, 8 hourly. And on day 6, we change now dexamethasone to prednisolone. And at that moment, we introduce now our anti-emetic drugs. So anti-epileptic, they respond very well. Usually it's one only. You won't even go to 2 drugs. You give one and usually they respond well. And the risk for seizures, it's when you get calcified brain lesions, when the patient is presenting with multiple seizures, and when you get multiple brain cysts.
Jorge, do you want to introduce Luisa from Mexico?
Just wanted to say briefly, Dr. Arredondo has been introduced to us as one of the shining and bright figures in Mexican neurosurgery. He's in Guadalajara, and with that introduction, I mean, he came highly recommended by all my senior colleagues from the country. So, Dr. Arredondo, you continue with your opinions about this subject of cysticercosis and the central nervous system.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lazareve. Can you hear me, everyone? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you for the kind introduction. Cysticercosis in Mexico, as in many other developing countries, is a major problem and still is health services public problem, and we have a major incidence of this disease in the last 5 years, which has been decreased from the first years of the 90s. We have in 1996, for example, about 1,600 cases per year, and in the last register in 2022, we have 225 cases. So we are seeing a diminished in the cases and in our country, and the major problem is, of course, the lack of preventive measures in the preparation of the food and the prevalence of the street food in Mexico.
So you noticed a decrease in the incidence. What do you attribute that to?
I think there is a major information and more education among the population, and I think it's because people are preparing best their foods and they are aware of being in risk of being with to acquire the disease in if they don't have the measures to take care of the food.
Luis, how do these people present to neurosurgery, with seizures or mass effect?
Most of them present with seizures, but some few cases are present with mass lesions, and the most prevalent form of cysticercosis is the parenchyma cysticercosis, and we have seen every day less cases of hydrocephalus associated with this disease.
Hello, Professor. I'm sorry, my network was bad. Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can hear you.
We were just hearing from Luis about his experience in Mexico, and actually your slides at the right time, because I was going to ask Luis, now that you're back, Cabullo, what are the drugs you use to treat them and how successful are they?
I'm almost at the end.
Please proceed,
Professor. Okay, thank you so much. So I think we use praziquantel, 50 milligrams per kg, and we divide it into three doses. Then the most used is albendazole, 15 milligrams per kg per day. Then we divide into two to 3 days. But we have to start first with steroid first before we introduce this one. Then how do we prevent them? It's measures, sanitary education, which is the most important strategy to control this disease, and hand washing, also installation of latrines or other hygienic measures for disposal of human waste. And in surgery may be used to establish the diagnosis. You can do the biopsy to get the definitive diagnosis. You can do stereotactic biopsy, which is well suited for small lesions, and CSF diversion. You do a ventricular peritoneal shunt to treat hydrocephalus. Surgery also might be indicated for spinal cyst, intraventricular cyst, which may be less responsible to medical therapy. When you get intraventricular, that's where people sometimes they do it endoscopically to go and remove the cyst into the ventricle. Otherwise, you get hydrocephalus. And the spinal cyst, once it grows, it will compress. You get the neurological deficit related to that. And surgery may also be used for giant cyst when intracranial hypertension does not respond to steroid. But though every case you are operating, you have to continue after the surgery, you have to continue with anti-helminthic drugs to complete the treatment. And follow up, we always do CT scan every 6 months until the lesions disappear completely into the brain. I will show you a 46-year-old male who was diagnosed with neurocysticercosis, and he went at the local facility. You see the picture here. This is the vesicular stage. You can see the lesions with a white dot inside. This is the scolex. This patient went somewhere, and he received albendazole without giving steroid. The patient deteriorated. The Glasgow Coma Scale dropped up to 9 on 15. So he could not walk, he could not talk for 2 years. Then this patient was referred to us. The moment the patient came to us, we did a CT scan control. This was the CT scan. It was now the calcified stage. You see only calcifications you can see into the brain parenchyma with active hydrocephalus. Then we shunted this patient. After shunting, a month later, the patient could walk and could pronounce a few words. Today, we are almost 4 months post CSF diversion, and we are planning to do a CT scan, though it's a very poor patient who could not even do a CT scan control soon after the diversion.
I think we just lost him again, but it was very, very, very good talk. Professor Cabullo. Luis, any more comments? What you just saw?
I have a question for Dr. I don't remember the name.
Cabullo.
Dr. Cabullo, excuse me.
He may not be connected. I think he got disconnected.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering how many shunt failures they have in their practice, or because the failure of the shunt in my country is very high because of this disease. So we need to do a revision of the shunt failure more than 2 or 3 times because of cysticercosis. I don't know what is the amount of revision of the shunt in his country.
Is that because of protein in the shunt, or
that's the main cause of the protein in the CSF, and it's not related mainly to the technique, but it's related, yes, to the protein content.
Are these shunts commercial shunts, or do you have shunts in Mexico that you make in Mexico that you use, or are they straight tubes?
No, most of the shunts come from South America. We don't have shunts made in our country. In the past years, we have shunts made in Mexico, but it's no more available, those shunts.
Okay. So with praziquintal and albendazole, what's the expectation for the reduction of the CSF protein content?
We need to expect at least 1 or 2 weeks to the proteins to decrease in the CSF. But sometimes we need to put a shunt very early, and we have a very high index of failure in the shunts.
Right. Thank you.
Well, we just got the end of Dr. Cabullo. It was a wonderful presentation, Dr. Cabullo. So as a neurosurgeon, do you see hydrocephalus as the most common? Do you see a large cyst as the most common? Do you see, what's your experience in Mexico? And then Cabullo can tell us and what he sees in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
The parenchymal presentation is most common. We personally, I have not made a surgery in the past 1 year related to neurocysticercosis, which resembles the decrease of the incidence of the disease. But mostly of the presentations are parenchymal, and fortunately not related to hydrocephalus, because the percentage of failure in shunts is very high.
There's a question in the chat about the option of external ventricular drainage before placing in a permanent shunt.
Yes, we use that. Yes.
Okay. I think Estrada Alvin wanted to ask a question.
Yes, Alvin has your, yes, Dr. Alvin, please go ahead. You have your hand raised.
Thank you, professors. So Dr. Cabullo, thanks for that brief presentation. I just want to know, what is the rationale of changing the steroids? You started with dexamethasone, and then you say after 72 hours, and then you gave prednisolone. Is there any, I don't know, I just need to know, what is the rationale? Why can't us continue with just one, either dexamethasone? Why should it be changed to another steroid? Thank you so much. Beautiful presentation.
Anybody answer the question about changing steroids? It's from a high dose, it's a high dose to a low dose, is I guess what I got out of that. But anybody in the audience have experience with that?
I think Dr. Cabullo, Dr. Doug was indicating that there was a change of the steroid type.
It looked to me like they wanted to prevent steroid dependence, but Jorge, do you know anything about that?
No, I would imagine that the patient dictates the dose and the opportunity, no? But I don't have any deep knowledge about that, no.
I think it may be because the prednisolone or prednisone in our countries is much more available in oral presentation, and dexamethasone is intravenous presentation. I think that's the origin of the change.
Ignatius, do you have any experience in Cameroon with this, or Sam? And yeah, go ahead, Ignatius. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Kabulu. That was a very excellent presentation. I actually work in the northern part of Cameroon, and it's majority Muslims. So for the past 4 years, I've just had two cases of neurocystic psychosis. And we actually even wrote a case report about a lady who was initially a Christian, and she used to eat pork, and then later converted to become a Muslim. But when we found a neurocystic psychosis in this case, we were a bit embarrassed, you know. So I don't have much experience with that. I've just had two cases over 4 years. And these were intraparenchymal cases. The patient presented with seizures, in bandage seizures, and then with anti-helminthic drugs, and the patient recovered without any problems.
Sam, do you see this in Nigeria?
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the presentation indeed. Nigeria, strangely enough, we eat a lot of pork in Nigeria. And this disease is it's not uncommon in Nigeria, but I have not encountered one neurosurgical case over the so many years I've practiced in Nigeria. It's a bit strange. Maybe we're missing them. We have all the diagnostic tools to be able to make the diagnosis, but I can't recall that we have treated any in my center.
Okay.
Dr. Osman. Do you mind if I add, we hear in our neurosurgery conference at UCLA from time to time that the patients who had the cystic psychosis, we had last year one from the spinal cord, they removed it completely without a rupture. And also I see many patients who immigrated from Mexico to Los Angeles. They come with seizure, they are on the anti-epileptic, because of the cystic psychosis. Unfortunately, this is the topic that is very insisted on neurosurgery, and they try to teach it, especially the medication the doctor presented is the one which is used. And also it was a beautiful, beautiful the presentation of this, because this is the topic I used to teach with Dr. Jorge Lazarev in the class for the students, just to make them aware, and your talk was excellent, and really I appreciate. And we see that in Los Angeles, we see it, especially the county hospital, we have the cases from time to time, and they know it very well, and they handle it beautifully because of the cases that we see. Thank you very much.
Mariela from Cuba, do you see this in Cuba at all, Mariela?
No, in Cuba it's very infrequent. I never seen before. I never seen in Cuba the neurocystic psychosis.
Okay, but it looks like Ignatius or Nim or Professor Kabulo that it's in concentrated in different areas of Africa. Is that true?
Yes. As I mentioned before, I work in the majority Muslim community, whereas Kabulo works in Lumumbashi, and I think it's a mixed community with the majority Christians. So Christians eat pork, but Muslims don't. So, for example, during my training, I was in Cairo. Over 7 years, I didn't see a case of neurocystic psychosis. In Cameroon, I've seen two. So I think that explains why Kabulo maybe has seen so many cases, whereas we are seeing very few.
Okay.
Nim had indicated that he had invited Dr. Okimwa to make.
Yeah, Dr. Okimwa.
Oh, Dr. yes, that's right. Please do.
Yeah, Dr. Okimwa couldn't make it.
Okay.
Dr. Okimwa couldn't make it. He's our neuropathologist. But we rarely see neurocystic psychosis in Kenya. Of all the years I've worked, we haven't done a surgery. I never did a single surgery. Dr. Kiboy, I think, is on this call. If Dr. Kiboy is now working at Kenyatta National Hospital, he could give us his comments. But yeah, Dr. Kiboy.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's true. We don't see a lot of patients with neurocystic in our setup, but that was a very good presentation. Really showcasing what we see in our country is more of hydatid cyst. The hydatid is common in our northern part of our country. And Professor, you are very much aware about our hydatid cyst but that very good presentation, and thank you very much.
Okay,
thank you.
I could comment. I mean, it was a wonderful presentation, and very, very informative, because I really don't know when I last revised neurocystic sarcosis, because as I said, we rarely see it. Hydatid disease is very common in our setup. Now, in our population, we have although the Muslim population is about 10%, majority is Christians, but still we don't see neurocystic sarcosis. I have discussed this with our physicians as to whether maybe they treat the condition, but even the physicians, our neurophysicians, they told me they don't see it. So I think this is one area would like to do, to go a step forward. I would like to follow up this with my colleagues in DRC to find out how come they see these cases and we don't see them. What's the epidemiological factor? What is the reason? You know, we would like, because the hygienic factors, the exposure factors are the same. So if that was there, we should be seeing these cases. So I really don't know why we don't see them. And this is why I wanted our neuropathologist to come and give me his views. But we do see cystic sarcosis. We see cystic sarcosis. It's a common problem in our country, but we don't see in Europe cystic sarcosis. Thanks.
Dr. Estrada, if
Dr.
you
King
permit.
Is raising the hand. I mean, yeah.
Yes, we have a raised hand. We should probably go on to Dr. Kawa's presentation, but let's hear from Dr. King, who has his hands raised. And there are questions in the chat, so if people can answer in the chat, that would be great. Go ahead, Paul. You're on mute.
You can hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I just had a comment. One, that Dr. Kabula's talk was outstanding. And I, all the times that I've traveled to Africa, I've not seen cystic sarcosis, but in America, I've treated about 10 patients with cystic sarcosis. And I think that we got to be aware, and our residents have to be aware of this problem, because we have so many immigrants, and we can't forget about cystic sarcosis because it's alive and well. And so I think that we have to keep that in our differential when treating patients, especially immigrants from all over the world.
Excellent, Paul. Saeed?
Yes, doctor, question. I wanted to mention that in south of Iran, which is a Muslim country, we have a lot of hydatidism. And as everybody knows, the animal involved is the dog, is the worm, the parasite grows in the intestine of the dog. And because of their excrement in the area, the people who get contaminated and it goes, then the treatment is totally different. And we had some talks from our colleague from Iraq who had a lot of cases like that. So it's a contrast, those who has in the Muslim world, if the dogs are contaminated, hydatidism is very prevalent and sometimes is very deadly. And those we have the pork using cystic sarcosis. And in the talk we had at UCLA, they have never seen a hydatidism, at least at UCLA, as up to now, because the animals are quarantined before coming to US and Canada. But there have been some cases from East Europe who have immigrated to Canada, 4 cases, they were contaminated with the hydatidism. Thank you, Ali.
Dr. Kabula, you raised your hand, and then we've got to move on, I guess. But first of all, just a wonderful talk, very nicely done, very informative. You want to make some comments?
Thank you so much, Professor. I'm very sorry about my network. Very sorry for that. I wanted to answer the question about changing steroid. When we give dexamethasone, it's injection, then Imagine someone who comes with neurocystic psychosis with no surgical indication, and you can't keep the patient for 10 days in the hospital while receiving steroid. Imagine dexamethasone, the tablets here, they are 0.5 milligrams. If you want to give 8 milligrams, it means the patient has to take 16 or more than that tablets at once. So if you go to dexamethasone, to prednisolone, it will be few tablets, then you discharge your patient. The patient continues the medication at home with the albendazole instead of keeping the patient with dexamethasone for long and injection and long period for oral or for injection of dexamethasone only in the hospital. That's the reason why we change. We change because with prednisolone, you take less pills than dexamethasone. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. Excellent.
Kabula, one other question. Why do you see it more commonly in your country as opposed to others? Do you know?
Yes, we see neurocystic psychosis, and those we are operating, they are less than those we are treating medically. Right. Even recently, we gave tablets to one of our colleagues, doctor, who had neurocystic psychosis, but with no hydrocephalus. He came already in the calcified stage, and we gave a tablet, and everything went well. So we see more of these cases. Like I can say I have, for 4 years, I have more than 30 cases of neurocystic psychosis.
So the presentation, I would guess, to neurosurgeons is parenchymal from seizures, maybe acutely from hydrocephalus. And the drug treatments, are they very successful or not?
Yes, many of them, they come with seizures. Adult onset seizure, when you do CT scan, you get you get the diagnosis. And others, when they've started somewhere, you know, neurosurgery is still a young discipline in my country. So sometimes patients are being kept somewhere where they are giving treatment like malaria and whatever. When they send, those we are operating, they arrive already with signs of raised intracranial pressure. You receive them already with hydrocephalus, then you shunt them. Mm.
Just a note before we go on to Dr. Kaba, it's turning out that ivermectin, which wasn't mentioned here, but is a commonly used for parasitic disease, and albendazole turn out to be very effective anti-cancer agents. And people are working on that and finding that. So they're very cheap, very effective, and very powerful, and very safe. Estrada, you want to ask Dr. Kaba to go on with this presentation? I think you're muted.
I think Dr. Kaba is ready, so please proceed. Thank you. It looks like he's getting started. Thanks.
Oh, terrific. Okay. Excellent. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health-related problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit and to help us improve our programming. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, and requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. This foundation supports Surgical Neurology International, SNI. It is a 2D internet journal. Its editor-in-chief is Nancy Epstein, and the web address is sni.global. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is a new 3D video journal, interactive with discussion, and its web address is snidigital.org. Both are free on the internet 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's the third largest neurosurgery journal in readership since 2010. And SNI Innovate Digital Innovations in Learning has now been viewed in 104 countries in 4 months. It's the first video journal of neurosurgery. Our goal is to help people throughout the world. This is also supported by the Medical News Network, which is dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This program is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, a USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. Copyright is 2024, all rights reserved. Thank you very much for watching.